You're listening to Upfront. I'm Annie Banks, and today I have the pleasure of sitting down with Tim Wise, an anti-racist speaker, educator, author, and also host of the podcast Speak Out with Tim Wise. Thanks for joining me on Upfront, Tim.
Thanks for having me.
Tim, for many years, you've been an active anti-racist educator all over the states and even internationally. How did you get into this work?
Well, you know, I started as an activist, I suppose in college. I did a little bit of activist type stuff when I was even in high school, but really, you know, I was being in New Orleans for college in the 80s, graduated in 1990, was involved in peace and justice work regarding Central America, anti-apartheid work regarding South Africa. And it was really during that time that I came into contact with some really incredible activists who were mentors to me in the city of New Orleans, who did a very good job, gently to some extent, helping me see the connections between the sort of international issues that I was, I guess, at that point, more comfortable talking about and focusing on, and the domestic issues that were taking place right down the block, from police brutality to racism in housing, economic inequality. So when I got out of college, it just so happened that that was when David Duke, former Klan leader, lifelong white supremacist, was running for the U.S. Senate in Louisiana. The year after that, he ran for governor of Louisiana. And the guys that started the organization that became the principal opposition group to Duke hired me to do campus organizing essentially around the state, and later became the associate director of that group. So it was during that time, you know, the sort of David Duke thing, that I came to realize that this activism thing, or whatever we call it, this advocacy thing, this movement building thing, wasn't going to be something that I could just do sort of as a hobby or, you know, in my spare time, but it really was something I needed to do and throw myself into full time, because who's going to fix white folks? I mean, you know, white folks definitely not going to just listen to black and brown folks. If they were doing that, they wouldn't have voted for the Nazi. So maybe, you know, those of us who are white can work with our people. And that was where it began.
A couple of things there that I'd love to ask you about. First, you talked about being involved with more international issues before looking domestically. First, what do you think of that phenomenon that sometimes does happen with white folks, especially where it's easier maybe to see white racism and white supremacy as manifesting elsewhere rather than at home?
Yeah, I mean, it happens all the time, and we've seen it again. We saw it during the sort of in the 90s when the campus anti-sweatshop movement was very big, even though there are sweatshops all over this country that are exploiting labor the same way. We're not making the connection between that and global sweatshops. You see it with the anti-war movement. You see it, you know, with a lot of different movements that focus on what's going on else. And that's not to say that that stuff is not important. It is vital work, and it's all part of the same larger system of global white supremacy. But I think it is because when you bring it home to the block, you know, and you bring it home to your community and you make those connections, now what you have to do is assess for yourself, what does that mean for me if I am the beneficiary of unjust privilege? It's one thing to say, oh, I'm the beneficiary of cheap clothing made in Sri Lanka or in Vietnam, but that's still abstract. You don't have to see the people in Vietnam or in Sri Lanka, but you certainly see the folks in your own community who have, you know, unsafe housing, dilapidated schools, inadequate access to healthcare. So I think it's a stage that people go through. Some people sadly never get through the stage and make the connections, but I think it's a stage almost every white person starts with because it's easier.
And conversely, I would say too, I've heard some concern from older activists in my life that there's less international focus these days, yeah. Especially among young anti-racist activists. What do you think about that?
Well, and that's true too, because what happens is you go through the phase where you start off focusing on stuff that's not in your, you know, front view mirror. And then you get focused on the domestic, and then you forget to make the connections with the international. So it can definitely cut in both directions. And I think it is important for us to understand the global nature of white supremacy, because that affects everything from trade policy to economic and monetary policy to our foreign and military policy. And if you don't understand, in fact, one of the things that really got me thinking about white supremacy, although I didn't necessarily stitch it together for a couple of years, was, you know, taking a class in college that I thought was going to be incredibly boring. It was about U.S. Latin American diplomatic history or something. But I was a Latin American studies minor, and it was sort of everybody said, oh, you got to take it. And I did. And we had a professor who taught this book called Race and Manifest Destiny by Reginald Horstman. It was written in like 1981. And it was the first time I'd ever read an analysis of United States foreign policy that looked at it through a race lens. I mean, I came out of sort of a neo-Marxist class lens, which is all fine and good as part of the lens, but the idea that foreign policy and everything the U.S. does is simply motivated by profit and corporate interest was never fully satisfying to me. And this book sort of put in perspective, like, no, we actually went to war with Mexico over the idea that Anglo-Saxon supremacy was at stake. And of course, there's been research now. We did the same thing in the Philippines. That was very much about, yes, economic motivation. It was also about this notion of racial supremacy. So I think if activists who are doing domestic work don't understand the connection with international, they're missing a piece of it. And if the folks who are doing global work don't understand how it affects the local, then they're missing a piece of it. We need to have a broader, more capacious perspective, but in both cases, one that puts white supremacy as a system sort of in the forefront.
Speaking of which, I've been thinking about how you organized previously, you know, against David Duke, and now we're seeing, I mean, as always, openly white supremacist politicians.
Yeah.
But at this point, we have an openly white supremacist president of the United States. Again, not that that's any different than many other presidents of the United States, but we are seeing a more overt form at this point. What are your thoughts on right now and organizing and resistance to this?
Well, it's very obvious, and we actually said it at the time. We just didn't know that we'd still be saying it a quarter century later. But even though Duke lost both of those elections, we said at the time, Dukeism won, because Dukeism as an ideological position, racially scapegoating people of color for problems they did not cause, which is sort of the fundamental basis of Dukeism, became ever more popular after he lost. I mean, Pat Buchanan started doing it. The Republican Party generally began to move further to the right and I mean, not necessarily further, but more blatantly, openly, because for years they were playing the dog whistle game. You know, it was about coded language. And even Duke played the dog whistle game. But now it is almost as if the right has been dragged so far to the right in terms of sort of white identity politics that the GOP, as my friend and podcast colleague Chauncey DeVega says, is sort of the largest white identity organization on the planet. And he's right in the sense that it has sort of gone all in as a white nationalist party. Now, I want to differentiate between strands of this, because it is not correct to say that Donald Trump is David Duke or that Donald Trump is the Klan. If we don't make delineations, then we sound ridiculous on the left. So I do want to say there are different levels of white nationalism. There's the Richard Spencer level where he says, I want a white ethno state, and he's very obvious about it, and Duke believes that too. Then there are people like Donald Trump who is either very comfortable with the idea of, if not making the U.S. entirely white, certainly making it really hard for it to be anything but that. He certainly plays that game. And it may be the case. You know, I was asked one time, do I think Donald Trump is a racist? Yes, in terms of his policy. There's no question that his policy and his rhetoric feed racism. So that his behavior is racist. The real issue is not whether he is, though. And I'd rather not focus on the individual. I'd rather focus on what they do, because, it's sort of like if you ask me whether about drug dealers, you know, like I don't really know if a certain drug dealer gets high on their own supply, so to speak, but I know what they're dealing, right? And so that's the bigger concern for me when it comes to Donald Trump. He's dealing racism. If he's just using it as a manipulative tool, then okay. But at least we know. And I think what's happened is that the acceptable racial terrain has moved so far to the right that now all the dog whistle stuff that they did, all the coded language that they did, which Lee Atwater famously talked about in 1981, you know, famous GOP consultant and strategist, acknowledged that they've been doing that since the 60s, that they couldn't say racial slurs openly anymore. They couldn't appeal to blatant racism. They had to talk about states' rights and taxes. And they still do that, but they also are saying Mexicans are rapists. And they also are saying black people live in hell and can't walk down the street without getting shot, so we need more cops in their neighborhood. And you know, blocking refugees clearly on the basis of ethnicity, color, and religion. So I think this time that we're in is dangerous because it signifies that in so many ways we haven't moved forward. We have moved backward. And I think, sadly, we're likely to see more of that because, you know, I wrote about this in Dear White America back in 2012. As the white population of this country sees itself becoming less than a majority, which it will be by 2042, roughly, you know, about half the country will be people of color, half will be white, maybe a little less than half white. And as the popular culture continues to become more multicultural, and after having had a black president and an economy that is no longer guaranteeing white people what it always guaranteed them, which is, you know, as long as you work hard, you'll be fine. All of those things combined, economic insecurity, cultural insecurity and anxiety, demographic shift, and the rise of black political figures, Obama and others, has created this sense of displacement in a certain group of white people. And the fear is that when they finally figure out, they really can't stop it. They you know, you can talk about building a wall and all that. You're not going to stop demographic change and cultural change. You don't stop. The world is always changing. And the problem is when you've been privileged, you've never had to think about that. And the danger now is, what do people do when they see you know, their world, quote unquote, crumbling. And I'm afraid some of them will turn to not only, you know, politicians like David Duke, but far more dangerous than that.
Are there strategies from your time organizing around David Duke or, I mean, to now? Because obviously this is, like you've said, it's not like any of that really went away. It's just gone through different phases. So what strategies do you think are most effective at this time?
Well, I think that there are two things that we learned during the anti-Duke work. One is that you had to focus and you had to separate the extremism from mainstream. And it's a dangerous thing to do because you don't want to diminish the fact that racism and white supremacy is sadly very mainstream. But you, if you're going to defeat extremist politicians, people who are likely, even though they're using mainstream concepts, they're trying to drag things further to the right. If you're going to defeat them, you do have to drive a wedge between them and the people they're claiming to represent. So there were many times in the Duke campaign that we wanted to simply rebut David Duke's beliefs on affirmative action or welfare or immigration because we knew he was wrong and we wanted to prove that he was wrong. But the problem with that approach, even though that's helpful and, you know, we do want to do some of that, is that normalizes David Duke, right? It was like saying, well, you know, he's no different than Ronald Reagan. Well, actually, and this is the danger sometimes we on the left get in. It's like, well, he's no different, you know, Donald Trump and David Duke and Pat Buchanan and Hitler, they're all the same. No, that they're not remotely the same, even if they play upon some of the same themes. And if you make the mistake of saying, well, Donald Trump is just like Reagan or just like Duke or just like Nixon or just like whomever, then you make him normal. Because there are a lot of people out there that actually, for whatever reason, still like Reagan and they still lionize him. So you don't want to normalize Donald Trump. You don't want to say that he's just like every other conservative politician, because if so, you make it easier for people to vote for him. So you want to say, listen, there's something about this politic that is incredibly toxic, even more than what we're used to normally. And we have to make voters actually feel a sense of shame for pushing that narrative. Now, the flip side of that, and this is going to sound contradictory, but we have to do them both at the same time, is we also want to remind people as we are trying to drive that wedge that he is playing upon, in this case, Trump, or when it was Duke, playing upon old tropes and themes. So he's both unique and not unique. He's unique in this moment in the approach that he takes, and he's uniquely dangerous at this moment. However, he is playing a tune that is the oldest tune in the book. And in this case, that tune is rich white guy telling not rich white people that their enemies are black and brown. So you want to both denormalize and normalize at the same time. And I know that sounds hard to do, but it's important. You want to remind people this is an old, actually what it is, it's a long con, right? It's a long con that rich white people have played on working class white people. And this guy is coming along at this particular time and doing it in such a toxic way that even if you find yourself drawn to some of his views, you just can't vote for this guy. And ultimately, if we hadn't done both of those things, David Duke probably would have won in 90 and 91.
I was wondering about this question of accountability, like how have you throughout your career, especially once you shifted into more writing and speaking, remained accountable to organizers of color, to communities of color that you're, you know, speaking about issues like white supremacy and racism? Yeah.
Well, a couple of ways when I started doing a lot of writing, you know, was I would always sort of run my writing by people before I published it. I would get ideas. First of all, I would take ideas about what I needed to be writing about. So I didn't just say like, I think I'll write about this. You know, I would either take suggestions from people or wait until I had recommendations from people about, hey, we need you to write about this. And then I would run it by people and before it would go out. And accountability also meant raising up the work in my writing of other people. So if that was something online, it meant that I needed to, you know, refer to people of color's work, whether that was by referencing them in the piece or putting them on some reading list that people could then go after they read my stuff, go read someone else's stuff. Same thing in speeches, you know, referring to the work of people of color and steering people toward that as a way to say, look, it's fine that you're here listening to my talk, but after this is over with, I need you to follow up. And I need you to follow up not with other white people necessarily or with me, but with people of color principally. One of the reasons of starting the podcast was I knew that that was a way, without question, that I could amplify voices. Now, there are still going to be people, of course, who are going to say, well, yeah, you amplified those voices, but what about these? And, you know, I got a show a week and I'm always wanting to take suggestions about who to have on. So I'm open to any of that sort of assistance in terms of hearing, because there are a lot of voices I don't know. You know, I know a lot of people, but I don't know everyone. So I try to keep my ear to the ground, so to speak, and my eyes open to find new folks who need that amplification and try to do what I can. But, you know, accountability is always a little bit of a dance. And I think the mistake that we make that a lot of white anti-racists make, and I've made it too, is we get so – accountability doesn't mean you necessarily have to wait for instruction. It means do it, and then if you screw it up and someone says, hey, you screwed it up, do it differently, then just do that. And I think I've seen white activists whose take on this is more like, well, we can't do anything until people of color give us the marching orders. That is not what accountability, in my estimation, has ever meant. It's certainly not what the concept, as it was taught to me by the People's Institute, the folks in New Orleans who really brought that into my lexicon. It's not what they meant. And you know, they're like, no, you got to go do some stuff, and then you got to be ready for the pushback when you don't do it right. That's what accountability means. It's not paralysis.
And I can see, as you're talking about that, how directly parts of what people like Robin DiAngelo have termed white fragility, I find really don't match with that need for kind of humble reflection and constant self-reflection and just a realistic approach to, like, yes, you're going to mess it up, especially when, as a white person, you don't know necessarily how to do the work. So you're learning.
Right.
But like you said, being accountable doesn't mean waiting for orders, because that's too easy. Like, you have to put yourself out there too.
Well, yeah. And actually, it inverts the responsibility once again. It seems like a really humble thing to do. And I know lots of white anti-racists on the left who think that that's like being – that's the proper way is to – and that it's humble and that it's a way you're supposed to, like, humble yourself. But the problem is that that puts the work back on people of color. Like, people of color, you're asking people of color to tell you what to do, and that's incredibly exhausting. People of color just want white folks to do something and to speak out about this stuff with other white people in particular, and to challenge in the spaces where they are. And you're going to do it wrong, but it's this left form of white fragility. You know, it's progressive white fragility, which is this, like, I don't want to get it wrong. Then what are you doing here? You know, if you're not prepared to get it wrong ever and get called out for doing it wrong and get sort of some constructive feedback, then you're not really ready for the work. And yeah, it doesn't feel good when you get called out. Nobody likes that. I mean, you know, we all have ego needs and we all have feelings. And so, yeah, when someone calls you out or challenges you, you know, but I think it's important to try to keep in mind, and I haven't always done this successfully, but I try to remember it, that it's really rarely personal when you get called out. It's about the work. It's not about you. It's about this system that has created this inequity. And as long as you don't internalize it, you know, I think you can move forward without that fragility, hopefully.
I have a question that I'm interested in. You quote James Baldwin.
A lot.
Yeah.
A lot.
As do I. I adore him. And his words have often left me with this question about whiteness as identity. Yeah. You know, he talks about whiteness being a very sort of hopeless thing to ground your identity in. Mm-hmm. And yet I have seen, and you talk about, and many people talk about, still there being a struggle to get white people to even admit mm-hmm. that they're white, or that there's privilege accrued due to their whiteness.
Right.
How do you see that?
Well, I think what Baldwin means when he says, you know, as long as you think you're white, there's no hope for you. I don't think Baldwin would deny, were he here today, that most white folks don't even want to admit they are white, but deep down he would say, but they've identified with it. In other words, there's an implicit identification that, and sometimes explicit, and that white folks do think they're white. They just don't want to think about what that means. So to me, that's how you smooth the contradiction. Yes, on the one hand, most white folks don't even want to, you know, you ask white folks about being white, and they'll say, I'm not white, I'm Irish, or I'm Italian, or I'm Jewish.
People
are
like offended by the word white.
And which is ironic, because we created it.
Right.
I mean, you know, so like you're offended by the term that you created to define yourself. It's not like someone put it on you. It's not like black folks used it against you like the N-word or something. I mean, it's just you created that. If you wanted to be Irish, you should have just stayed Irish. You know, if you wanted to be Italian, you should have stayed that. By cleaving to whiteness, what Baldwin was saying, whether you do it consciously or subconsciously, I would imagine he would think, you've doomed yourself. And he goes into all kinds of reasons as to why that is, because it requires a negation of who the self really is. It requires that you actually believe, for instance, that your ancestors wanted to come to this place, as he also famously said. And if you believe that, if you actually think, as a quote-unquote white person, that your ancestors wanted to come here, then what you've done is erase the pain and the struggle and the suffering that forced them in most cases to come. And you've made it seem like it was just this romantic grand adventure on behalf of liberty and justice, as opposed to the fact that those Europeans were, as Baldwin said famously, that, you know, they were broke, they were poor, they were tired, they were hungry, they could not make it. Some of them were criminals. if we forget that we were the losers of Europe, then that's why we turn against the quote unquote losers of other countries who were coming out of desperation, who haven't been able to make it and need a new shot. That's why we turn on them. That's why the immigration debate right now is so toxic, because white folks have decided that we are indeed white, have always been white, and we're coming here looking for something other than the ability to just keep breathing, you know. And I think that's what he means is you just don't have any hope, because you can't build solidarity with people when you think that your story is so fundamentally different, when in fact, in so many ways, it's not. This is a country filled with the losers of wherever they came from, except for indigenous people. But everyone else, you know, was either, and I don't mean loser in a negative sense, African peoples who were stolen from their own land are not losers, but in a sense, they lost that battle and they were brought here against their will. And the white folks who stole them, ironically, and set up shop here in so many cases really weren't the winners either. You know, they were also the ones that couldn't make it and decided to strike out and to go to a different land. And until we see each other in that way, until we see each other as the castoffs in one sense or another of other places, then we'll always be this xenophobic, closed border kind of mentality place.
That was Upfront contributor Annie Banks speaking with anti-racism activist Tim Wise. And up next, we continue with the extended interview with contributor Annie Banks speaking with anti-racism activist Tim Wise and a theater review of Richard Walensky on the new musical Soft Power, now playing at the Kern Theater through July 8th. That's all next after the news.
I'm glad you brought up the current discussion around xenophobia, immigration, everything. And I'm curious, what kinds of conversations are you having now as you're on the road under this administration in these times?
Well,
what are you talking to people about?
You know, I'm the conversations that I'm hearing are very much about who are we as a nation? And that's, you know, the one thing perhaps, if there's any silver lining from this administration existing, it is that it is forcing us to have a conversation, probably a long overdue conversation, about what America is and is not and what it's going to be. What is this country? Is this country a blood and soil country? Or is this an ideational nation? And if it's an ideational nation to which people can cleave and become part, then what is that ideal? What is that ideal? Because it seems to me we have a lot of contradictions at the heart of the American experiment that the immigration debate bring up, right? We have this idea of e pluribus unum, which has never really meant much. It's just on the money, right? But this idea out of many one, which seems to lend itself toward pluralism. But that stuff's been on the money for a long time and we didn't really mean it. Or we've had, you know, with liberty and justice for all at the end of the pledge. But I mean, that's been around since the 1880s and that didn't mean anything. We had Thomas Jefferson saying, you know, all men are created equal, but he owned 230 people when he wrote it. So he didn't mean it. I mean, so we've always had these contradictions and they've never been more clear, I think, than they are right now in the immigration debate. So if this forces us to have a conversation about how did we actually get here, those of us who are now so ready to close the door on others, what is our actual story? What was really our trajectory? Because the minute you start to explore that and you come down off your high horse, you know, that people are thinking like, well, you know, my family came here for freedom and liberty. No, they came here for land and just so they wouldn't die. And when you start, you know, all this, you know, I've done Ancestry.com. A lot of people have traced their stuff and it is fascinating. But the dangerous thing about Ancestry, I remember when I did it, was like you sit there and you're waiting for that little leaf to pop up that's going to show you your connection to some famous person, some wealthy person, some powerful person. And aside from the sickness of wanting to identify with the elite, the reality is that's not what you're going to find 9 times out of 10. You're going to find peasant class people because that's who you are. But why are you ashamed of that? Well, you're ashamed of that because you've been taught to be ashamed of that. And the more you're ashamed of that, the more you're going to take out that shame on other people who also were peasant class coming from wherever they're coming from. So the sickness at the heart of our country is this unwillingness to actually look ourselves in the mirror and see who we actually are and how much we've lost as a result of whiteness and bonding with that concept and giving up, you know, who we were when we came.
And it seems like upholding a lot of those tropes.
Yeah.
To this day, one story you shared that really impacted me, you were talking about the national anthem.
Yeah.
And the immense hypocrisy of the fight over, you know, courageous players like Colin Kaepernick taking a knee.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I'm not sure what it was that you saw that was so moving or what the story was. I may be blacking out on that. But for me, the contradiction, right, is that this notion that protesting the national anthem, let's say, is sort of an inherently unpatriotic act, which I think is this ubiquitous belief in white America. Whether they say it's disrespecting the flag as a piece of fabric or a symbol, or whether they say it's disrespecting the military, which is even less logical, almost all, it seems, not almost all, but clearly the overwhelming majority in poll after poll say it's inherently unpatriotic. But it seems to me this is, you know, and I'm not, I think patriotism is very problematic, and I've called it in the past, I've called it a pathology in the sense that I think it's a deviation from a normal and healthy state of humanity, which is to say that one, and Dr. King sort of said it much more eloquently than I, of course, but he said, you know, that we needed to get past tribe and race and nation and adopt a world global perspective. That's what I mean when I say patriotism is pathological, because it almost inevitably leads to hypernationalism. But if it has any value at all, then, or if we just think of it as love of country alone, right, which is great. I think everyone should love where they're from and try to make it as great as it can be. Then the most patriotic thing, in the positive sense of that word, the most place-loving thing would be to protest injustice in that place because you, precisely because you see it as a betrayal, right? If Colin Kaepernick and other ball players did not think that this country were capable of better, then they would not waste their time, and they certainly would not tank their careers if they did not think that it was possible to make it better. They're not doing this just for, you know, just for funsies, right? And so those of us who criticize the nation, whether we do it at that particular moment during the anthem and refuse to stand or refuse to do the pledge or whatever it is, or refuse to genuflect at the sight of the flag, we're doing it because we feel a betrayal. We were told we had one country. We have come to see that we have a very different country, and that enrages us precisely because we love the country and the people in the country. And to me, it's the most patriotic thing. The least patriotic thing, again, using patriotism in a very limited sense, because anything beyond that, I'm not really down for. But the most place-loving patriotic thing you could do is protest. The least patriotic place-loving thing you could do is sort of look at the country and go, well, you know, I guess the best we can do is black and brown folks 2 to 3 times more likely to be unemployed than white folks. I mean, you know, what are you going to do? Or gosh, I guess we're just not capable of reducing the wealth gap, which right now is, you know, median white family 15 times the wealth of the median black family, 12 times the wealth of the median Latinx family. Oh, well, that's the best we can do. Really? That's the best that, you know, America can do? I mean, you know, we can put people on the moon. We can do all kinds of stuff. We can cure various diseases, not as good as we used to, I suppose. We, you know, theoretically we can, but we can't. We can't reduce the wealth gap. We can't reduce the gap in shootings of unarmed black folks 3.5 to 7 times, depending on which data you believe, more likely to be shot while unarmed than white folks. We can't reduce the incarceration gap. We can't reduce that the 8-year life expectancy difference between white folks, black folks, and brown folks. I mean, if you're saying we can't do that, you're just going to shrug and throw your hands up, then you're the one who's saying, yeah, our country's really sort of pretty second rate. Like, we just can't fix any of this. And you know, the irony is Donald Trump on the campaign trail, that was sort of his message. His message was sort of like, America sucks. I mean, he said, we're a third world country. We don't do anything right. We don't do infrastructure right. We don't do trade right. You know, we're a mess. And you know, we need to, quote unquote, make America great again, which by definition implies that America sucks wind right now. Well, if Colin Kaepernick doesn't even say that, he doesn't say it like that. He just says, look, we got these really profound problems. Well, you hate America. Rich white dude says America sucks wind, and that's why you should elect him. And everybody goes, oh, that's great. You remember, you know, Barack Obama in 08, his slogan was hope and change. And that was pretty, you know, vague and banal, I suppose. And we can certainly critique the Obama administration from the left, and I have. But like, right-wing folks lost their mind. White Americans, at the thought that this black guy was saying hope and change, and they heard the song, they heard the word change, and they were like, wait a minute, oh, whoa, 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 Barack Obama, I don't want your change. And they, you know, had shirts that said keep the change. Like, that was, you know, very clever. Mm-hmm. So all Obama was saying was, there's some stuff we need to sort of work out, right? And the right wing was just, well, that's offensive. You hate the country. And then this guy comes along, basically says America sucks. And they're like, yeah, it sure does, you know. And that just goes to show that white people can complain all day long about the country and get away with it. And that patriotism is really for black people, meaning that's what we expect black and brown folks to do to show us how much they love the country that we've made a mess of in most cases.
and there will be serious consequences for stepping outside of that.
Absolutely.
I think the piece that struck me when you were talking about the anthem was the line, I believe, that is no longer part of the anthem, but, you know, something like the blood of
slaves. Oh, yeah, there's a whole stanza.
Running in the streets.
Yeah, there's a whole stanza of the anthem. I think it's the third one originally. That is an incredibly horrific, and that's why we don't sing it anymore. It's still technically part of the song. It was part of the sung version of the song for a long time. And it goes to the history. This Francis Scott Key wrote this song after a particular battle that had taken place in and around Baltimore. And this was at a time when we're talking about now the War of 1812, I guess. And there were enslaved people who he deemed to be not sufficiently patriotic, and they were actually, in some cases, helping the British, right? And that was disloyal. And so this song was really a revenge fantasy in many ways, not only against the British, obviously, whom Key was teeing off on, so to speak, but also against the disloyal black enslaved person. So that third stanza talks about the blood of the slave. It running in the streets of Baltimore, in a sense, is what he's talking about, and how that would be this sort of glorious sight that would somehow redeem, I suppose, the flag and the country, and that's what they deserve, just like the Brits deserve. And so it was sort of a middle finger to the Brits, but it was also a middle finger to black folks who didn't, in his mind, love the country enough. Well, you know, are we surprised that there'd be some black folks willing to fight for the Brits to gain their freedom? The same thing happened during the Revolutionary War. There, you know, the Crown was offering freedom to African peoples who would fight against the colonists. And why would we be surprised that some would? Yeah, I'll take that. You know, of course. And so it really is this sick revenge fantasy, sadistic revenge fantasy that, frankly, even if Colin Kaepernick doesn't mean to disrespect it, he probably should. And we should disrespect it because it's a disrespectful song. We need a different – if we're going to have a national anthem, we need somebody to get on writing a new one, because that one is unnecessary for sure.
Right. Yes. It seems like all of our incredible – due diligence to not in any way support that anthem.
Yeah.
So you've talked about how, you know, a few years ago during the Obama administration, when people are talking about, you know, now we're in post-racial America, the work of anti-racist educators was often to continue to keep the heat on. Like, racism has not ended. You know, here are all the examples of the way that racism is still manifest everywhere.
Right.
What is the shift in conversation now that you're talking with people
about? Well, I think the shift is that, on the one hand, you know, the good news is when you have so much blatant, obvious racism being spewed from the top levels of the government, you absolutely have a harder time denying that it's a thing. So the part about having to do the 101 and hold people's hand and convince them, hey, this is still happening, that part isn't as hard to do now. My sense of it is that if you can't see racism now, you're never gonna probably see it. And I just need to stop trying to convince you and just move on and mobilize the people who already see it. The danger of that, though, even as it helps us crystallize and it helps some white folks go, oh, okay, that's I see it now. The downside of that is if all you're seeing is the blatant and the obvious and the hateful stuff and the 25% increase in hate crimes roughly over the last 18 months and the 19 murders that have been committed approximately, I think last count, by white supremacists, so-called alt-right folks, neo-Nazis, white nationalists, then it becomes very easy for certain white folks, and by that I mean even, you know, especially white liberals, I think, to sort of draw a line between themselves and those folks, right, to say, well, God, those people in Charlottesville sure were horrible. I'm glad I don't know anybody like that. And I'm glad I know better than that. And you get sort of – and this happened during the anti-Duke work. We saw this, you know, where it was white folks who thought the fact that they, you know, knew not to vote for the Nazi made them somehow, you know, like amazing people. Well, if the best you can say is that you're not a Nazi and don't support Nazis, you probably need to go back to the drawing board about how you determine your own character. That's really that's like the baseline, lowest level of humanity is I'm not a Nazi, pretty much. And so my fear is that white liberals will content themselves and white progressive folks will content themselves with this notion that really fighting racism is about, you know, defeating the hardest edge part of fascism, rather than realizing that, you know, the inequities that I mentioned a second ago, inequities in wealth, inequities in health, education, criminal justice, jobs and income, all of that stuff predated Donald Trump. All of it is going to exist in one form or another after Donald Trump's administration, whether that lasts the next couple of years or just the next couple of days. That's going to be there. And David Duke didn't create it. Richard Spencer is not to blame. The white nationalist movement is not to blame. Those boys in Charlottesville are not to blame for the fact that black and brown folks with college degrees are anywhere from 50 to 85% more likely than whites with degrees to be unemployed. They're not responsible for the fact that black students are twice as likely as white students to be taught by the least experienced teachers and white students twice as likely to be taught by the most experienced, or that schools that are attended by black students and Latinx students are 10 to 12 times more likely to be places of concentrated poverty. David Duke didn't do that. Neo-Nazis didn't do that. School systems that we are part of did that. And so my fear is that we're now so focused on the extreme, because there's so much of it, that we're forgetting that there's an underlying institutional and systemic force here that is going to be in play long after, hopefully, some of this extreme stuff fades. And we got to be just as resilient and focused on that as we are on the overt extremism.
And the intersections of those things as well, right? Like, you know, when I hear you talk about David Duke not being responsible for, you know, the school system. And at the same time, it does conjure images for me of like Klan members who by day were police officers or mayors or...
Right.
So all the ways that those fronts kind of support each other and feed this.
Well, and even if there were no overt white supremacist in policing, if you have white supremacists out there on the web, let's say, who are concocting a narrative and crafting and distributing a narrative about black criminality and black dangerousness and immigrant criminality and immigrant dangerousness, you know, people who are police and in law enforcement, people who are teachers and in classrooms are going to see that stuff. You know, it used to be hard to see that stuff. You had to actually go and make an effort to see some of that stuff. Now that stuff's like one click away. And so those people who maybe themselves would never be members of any hate group at all and might even be really like not like hate groups and not like Nazis, nonetheless can be influenced by some of this really slick right-wing racist propaganda that doesn't come, you know, with a swastika at the top of the webpage. You know, it comes with these sort of highbrow organizations that use statistics. They use them in a very manipulative and distorted way, but they use sort of quote unquote what looks like evidence. And it can be very persuasive to people. And so that ends up defining the legitimate racial terrain for people who themselves would never join a hate group. So if you've got to, it's why it is important to fight the extreme, because the extreme pulls the mainstream further with it. It's just that we don't want to forget that as we're fighting the extreme, you know, let's remember there's this other underlying thing, because one of the things that happened after David Duke was defeated, it was interesting. The name of the organization that I was part of was the Louisiana Coalition Against Racism and Nazism. It was not the Louisiana Coalition Against David Duke, but a lot of the people who funded the organization and got behind it, as soon as Duke was defeated, it was like, oh, good, now we can move on to the next thing, rather than saying, wait, is there no more racism or even for that matter, Nazism in Louisiana? Because I'm pretty confident there is. Certainly at least the first part of that. So even if you think we got rid of the Nazism piece for a minute, like this other word in the title is right here, and we got to deal with that. And there were a lot of folks that were like, oh, let's move on. And so that to me is a danger that, you know, a quarter century later, roughly a little bit more than that, we're still looking at and dealing with.
Thank you so much for coming in. I'm curious, do you have any sort of parting words?
You know, the only thing I try to leave people with is a realization, particularly people who get hopeless in this moment, because it's easy to and there are days, look, when I'm not optimistic. I mean, you know, I'm not known for my sunny disposition about this stuff, but I do think it is important to remember that people of color in this country have survived bigger and badder dragons and demons than Donald Trump. This guy's a clown compared to some of the people that they have, the dragons that people of color have slain before. And, you know, I thought about this when I went to the African American History Museum, the Museum of African American History and Culture in D.C. And you see, you know, the evidence of, yes, the pain, but you also see the evidence of progress and victories. You see, yeah, there's Thomas Jefferson with the, you know, names of his enslaved persons on bricks behind him in a wall that's part of the exhibit. But you also remember that at the end of the day, Jefferson was defeated and enslavement was defeated by the work of disproportionately black folks in the abolitionist struggle and black troops in the Civil War, and by concerted efforts to destroy that system. You see you know, Bull Connor hosing down children in Birmingham on video there, and Jim Clark beating black people and their white allies on the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma. But you remember that Bull Connor is dead and Jim Clark is dead. And those systems that they fought to uphold, segregation in its purest form, were defeated again, mostly by the efforts of black folks. So if Jim Clark and Bull Connor and Thomas Jefferson and George Wallace could not defeat black folks and people of color generally, I am fairly confident that Donald John Trump is not the one.
I think that's an excellent note to end on.
Thank you. It was
good to be here. Thank you so much, Tim. You bet.